I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. We've all seen pictures of young people crowded into bars, socializing without masks, and not keeping a safe distance from each other. Colleges that have opened for the new school year have seen spikes in COVID-19 transmissions, forcing students to self-quarantine or be sent home. Now, young people are not the only ones defying public health guidelines to slow the spread of the coronavirus pandemic, but their age and development puts them at risk for taking risks. Here to help us understand why young people do what they do and what can be done to help them to take steps to protect themselves and others is Dr. Frances Jensen. She's professor and chair in the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, author of a book called The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. And Frances Jensen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here this morning.
So much to talk about. Before we even get to this adolescent, young adult brain that is still developing, as you write, help us understand the thinking of a young person that says to themselves, oh, I'm going to go to a party. I'm not going to wear a mask. I'm not going to socially distance. I'm not going to do the things that the public health and perhaps even my parents tell me to do. Help us understand that thinking.
Yes. Well, their brain at that stage in development is wired for risk-taking and also for social connectivity. So if you think about both of those things, it's driving these kids and young adults to want to mingle and be amongst, you know, social groups, because this is a very important time for their brain development relating to their social development. So they are more motivated than, say, adults are to break rules because they want to see past those rules. It's more of a drive to be socially connected. They are not necessarily thinking about the consequences, and we can get to the brain science behind that.
Well, absolutely. And as you said, you know, the brain for a teenager or young adult is sort of wired for these kinds of risky behaviors, and certainly much more risky now in the midst of a pandemic. So take us inside the brain. When you say it's not developing, what is it doing? What does the brain look like?
Yeah, so their brains, while they look like adults, they aren't yet fully adult. Their brains are not developed until mid to late 20s fully, and they're beginning to build the most sort of social and executive function areas of their brain in that window, whereas childhood is for sort of the more primary parts and the primary skill sets. So our brain actually connects itself region to region to region throughout life, throughout these first two or three decades of life. And the last place to fully connect with functional connections is a place called we call the frontal lobe, which is actually where we have our organizational skills, our executive skills, judgment, impulse control, decision making. And while they can make decisions, obviously, the rapidity with which they make decisions is going to be a little bit slower than in adulthood. We have fast speed connections to that part of our brain that develop as adults. And that's why we can say, bad idea, don't do that. They are not able to do that in the moment, and that is why they tend to take more risks.
Well, picking up, so we're talking about the frontal lobe. As you say, that's where this executive function is. So is it kind of free-floating in this young brain? As you said, it's not really connected yet. Take us inside this frontal lobe.
Yeah, so our brain has, you know, different parts of our brain have different specializations. We have a visual part, we have a motor and a sensory part, but then we also have an emotional part of our brain, which is, you know, an area called the limbic system, for instance. And the frontal lobe is right behind, you know, your forehead, and we connect our brain from back to front. So the last place to have full high-speed connections is the frontal lobe. And while we have lots of brain cells, neurons, that are busy talking to each other through connections called synapses, in each region, the regions have to connect to one another to coordinate function. And that requires these long tracks of brain neuron processes called axons that have to be insulated, if you will, because it's electrical signals. So they have to be insulated with a fatty substance, and that takes a long time to build, getting wrapped around these miles of connections that we have in our brains. So that's still taking place at the more front part of your brain. Interestingly, as adolescents, the limbic part of your brain, the emotional, sexual part of your brain, impulsive, you know, the impulses come from is very well connected by adolescence because it's about where your ears are. So it's behind the frontal lobe. So it's connected at a time when the frontal lobe isn't. And that's why sometimes we talk about, you know, teenagers being Ferraris with weak brakes, if you will, that the, you know, the frontal lobe is there to sort of say, put reason into things like, don't do that. It's not a good idea. And let's remember that this social part of the brain is also in that limbic area, very much driven our social behavior. And the whole concept of peer pressure and immediate gratification from friends, that's all wired very well, and that's why it's driving them, you know, as a primary driver, as opposed to maybe later in adulthood where you are like, well, I'd like to do that, but the consequences would be such that I shouldn't. And hence we get to COVID and the fraternity parties, right?
Absolutely. I mean, what you're describing really is a brain that is still under construction. But, you know, we know that some adolescents and young adults are risk takers and some are not. Is there something different about their brain, something different about their experiences, their environment, their life?
Yes. Well, we believe that the environment can very much modify, you know, how much you learn and how quickly you learn it. But again, these are averages. So there's going to be people whose brains are just genetically maturing faster than others. And they also may have learned explicitly, you know, cause and effect in certain situations and make better judgments as a result of that. And that's a really important thing to bring up here is that while we're kind of saying that the teenage brain has weaknesses, the teenage brain has unbelievable strengths. And those are that is able to develop those connections between brain cells called synapses that I talked about. All of the machinery to build those is set at higher levels in childhood and teen years compared to the adult. Therefore, they can learn much more quickly. They can learn, you know, skill sets, motor tasks, sports, music, memorization much faster than they will later. And so it is a learning machine, the teenage brain. And I think that's something the educational community is really realizing, that in this window of the teen years, you can actually even change your IQ, whereas we thought it was set much earlier in life.
Well, picking up on that, and because we are all living under this pandemic, and if we don't follow these public health guidelines, there are risks to ourselves, but also risks to other people. Then how do you appeal to this young person with this developing brain to take steps to protect not just themselves, but the people that they come in contact with?
Yeah. So I think, you know, first of all, parents and teachers and those around, you know, in the community around teenagers should recognize this is neurobiology. This is brain development playing itself out in front of you. And you can't expect them to grasp things in the exact way an adult would. You have to be very explicit, you know, and point out that A plus B equals C and use as many examples from the environment that are relevant to them in their town or in their school or in their community. This person did that and they got COVID and this bad thing happened to them or their grandmother. You have to really lay it out for them. And I think parents can do a very good job. I always say that we as adults have our frontal lobes connected and accounted for, and we need to give teenagers frontal lobe assist from time to time. And this would be one time where it's really important. You have to talk to them with respect and make it relevant.
And make it relevant in their lives so that it means something.
Yes.
I know you raised two boys. I think they're adults now, but are boys different from girls?
Yes. Well, yes. We do know that much of brain development, including the that process of connectivity, the insulation part that I was talking about, and also the rate at which the synapses are connecting are a little bit later in boys. They reach maturity later by about 2 years. You know, for like a 15-year-old girl is like a 17-year-old boy, for instance. On average, there are many early boys and late girls, but we do see that gender difference play itself out, I think, especially in, you know, mid to late teenage with respect to the risk-taking that we know can happen.
I'm thinking about the stress that we're all living under, but there are things called toxic stress where young people are living in either an environment that is dangerous or threatening, or in a family that is dangerous or threatening. How do we help them under those circumstances?
Yeah, I think we have to really be very mindful of this, because remember, you and I have just said the brain is under construction in this window, and anything that affects the construction project of that month will make it be a different product than it would have been under normal circumstances, right? So stress, sleep deprivation, drugs, other kinds of trauma will modify exactly kind of that stage that the brain was in at the time of the trauma. And that's why we can see sometimes that, extreme stress in adolescence can have more of a long-term effect on how your brain will be later as an adult than it would be, say, for an adult experiencing the same amount of stress. So we do, as a society, have to be extremely mindful that they are very sensitive to this, and to make sure that we can, pick up the signals from a teenager under stress, and also our society. We need to support them. I think it's going to be obviously a real challenge given, schools are now mostly online, and we have to find new ways to keep children and adolescents connected. I do have some hopes that actually these adolescents who are so good and they've learned so well how to manage the internet and they're so comfortable with it, that actually I think the adolescents and young adults are going to be able to get more from online learning, say, than possibly a child in this window of time. So I'm hopeful that they will, be able to manage their learning. But at the same time, we as adults around them, those parents that are in the house, need to try to think about how to create schedules to simulate something like school, make sure the kids are getting exercise, make sure they're not becoming sleep deprived and staying up too late. Exercise helps learning. We know that it consolidates learning. This is a very important time for learning. And I think that with those kind of modifications in place, this school year is going to be able to be effective for this age group, especially.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. Just a quick question. We're almost out of time. Jerry wonders, when does this impulse for risk-taking and decision-making start? Is there a start point, or is this just sort of a characteristic of this young adult teenage brain?
I think around puberty, late childhood is when you start to see, it's all about this connectivity, which is a wave of coming from the back of the brain to the front, right? And this limbic system is connecting, right in your early teens and late childhood. And then it really connects with the absence of the full connectivity of the frontal lobe. So you see the onset sort of around puberty, which is, I think, what we all experience in our society.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us a lot to think about. That's Dr. Frances Jensen. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she's the author of The Teenage Brain, a Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. We are talking about adolescents and young adults on today's Radio Times, helping them through this difficult time. We've got two more guests. They'll be joining us after a very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A recent CDC report found that many young people between the ages of 18 and 24 are struggling with depression and anxiety, with a quarter of them reporting that they had considered suicide. And no wonder, with the pandemic upending their lives, forcing schools to go online, giving them less opportunity to be with their friends, and unemployment putting stresses on families and putting family members at risk if they are essential workers. For young people of color, news stories about police-involved shootings are traumatic, making them feel vulnerable. So what can we do to help them? Joining us is Lisa Damore. She's a child and adolescent psychologist, writes the Adolescence column for the New York Times, co-host of the podcast Ask Lisa, The Psychology of Parenting. She's also a regular contributor to CBS. And Lisa Damore, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. You can jump in anytime. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Lisa, I was thinking over, let's say, just the last 20 years, September 11th. Recession, several wars, environmental crises, political crises, and now, of course, the pandemic. It's a kind of obvious place to start, but no wonder young people are feeling so much stress.
I think that's true. I mean, how can you look at all of that and not sense that things feel kind of out of control and worry about what you're inheriting as an adult and worry about where things are headed? I think for teenagers to feel high stress and anxiety right now is probably a sign that they're having the right feeling at the right time. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily evidence that they are misunderstanding the landscape that we're in right now.
But it's hard to live with stress and anxiety. I mean, even if it's real and healthy.
Absolutely. And especially when it's as persistent as it has been. You know, we are designed as humans to have anxiety. It helps protect us. It helps keep us safe. It alerts us when something's wrong. Stress can foster growth. It always does. That, you know, whenever we're learning or working at the edge of our capacity, it's stressful, but we're growing. But we're not really equipped or designed to have persistent anxiety and persistent stress. And so that's where we need to get very serious about helping young people get breaks from it, find places where they feel comfortable, find areas where they feel hopeful. It's the ongoing nature that is worrisome here.
I'm thinking of the parents that I know of teenagers or even young adults, many of them now stuck at home with each other. And what I hear from the parents is they feel like they're terrible parents. They are not terrible parents, but they feel as if they cannot hold all the pieces together. They can't make sure their children are online and learning or doing their homework and carrying on a job and dealing with maybe their parents who might be, you know, dealing with some other pandemic related issue. I think everyone just feels just so embattled.
I think that's right. I mean, everyone is worn thin. And if we look at it from the parenting perspective, one of the things we're missing are all of the infrastructures that help us take care of our kids and help us, you know, make sure that our kids are growing and learning, you know, going to school, doing their extracurriculars, time at camp, time over at other kids' houses. Those things have been taken away from us. And right when work for us got more complex and more difficult, it's a lot. And I worry about teenagers, and I also worry about their parents, because it's very hard for a kid to be doing better than their parents are. So part of how we're going to take good care of kids is to make sure we are doing everything we can to support parents.
Ah, and let me just pick up on that, because they need us.
Yes.
I mean, they look to us, right? I mean, and I have to say, I don't have a teenager in my house anymore, but, you know, when you live with a teenager, you feel like they don't really want to be with you. They don't want to hear what you have to say.
They can look like that. But teenagers tell us all the time, and they tell me all the time as a psychologist, how much they value their parents, how much their parents mean to them. But often, I actually wrote an article a long time ago called "What Do Teenagers Want? Potted Plant Parents." They want us around, they want us available, and they want us agendaless. And that's often where we get it wrong. Often when we are talking to teenagers, we have some angle or agenda. That's not their favorite. But our steady presence means a huge amount to them. And parents create the atmosphere in the home. And then teenagers and kids are living within that atmosphere. So we matter, even if teenagers don't always make us feel as adored as we would want to be.
So if teenagers are looking to their parent, and we should talk about young adults as well, because I think, you know, it's all part of this, the same group that we do want to talk about. So in specifics, what do they want from their parents under these circumstances?
Well, I use the term steady presence, and that's been on my mind a lot. And what it connects to is a much broader collection of research that we have in child and adolescent psychology about what really helps kids thrive. And if you took all the papers we have, thousands of research papers, and put them in a machine, what they would drop out are two things. Kids need warmth and they need structure. Hmm. They need to know that they are loved and they need to have a sense of predictability at home. That's what kids need from their parents. And we don't have to be, you know, A plus on both every day. I would go for a high average over a week. And that for me takes the chaos of the moment we're in and simplifies it to two things that I myself as a mother can focus on. And that feels more doable than trying to make everything all right all the time, which we cannot do.
Or feeling sorry for them.
Yeah, I think they need empathy. I'd steer clear of pity. Teenagers and kids are resilient. And when, you know, we lay out expectations, they tend to rise to them. So I would treat them with respect, have high expectations. I loved what Dr. Jensen said about how nimble they are in their learning, how quickly they learn. They're more adaptable than we are. So I think if we go in with the expectation that they will be resilient and we can help them get there, that's much more likely to be the outcome we get.
Let me read a couple of emails. And we have a third guest who'll be joining us. We just need to hook up with him. Dave asks or says, no wonder the young are stressed out. Our society has prioritized adult comforts over children's needs. Bars and gyms are open. Schools are closed. What do you think of that, Lisa?
Well, I think kids are making that observation, too. You know, one of the reasons I have dedicated my professional life to teenagers is I love being around them, and they are pretty quick to detect hypocrisy. And I have heard teenagers say, no, wait a minute, why is it that people are in bars but we're not in school? And that is a tough question to answer. And I am with your listener, and I am hearing it from the kids I care for, too.
Interesting. An email from Bob. He says, I grew up in the 1960s and 70s. I don't think I would want to be a young person now. And I feel sorry that the world these kids have to navigate is one largely created by my generation. The society we are leaving them is broken. What do you say in response to that?
What I say is, though we do see some kids feeling worn down by it, I also spend a lot of time with teenagers who are energized, who are excited to get to vote, who are thinking ahead. This generation of young people is so much more plugged in than I ever was. They engage in discourse with one another about all things political, all things social, at a level that nothing before it have I seen. And a lot of it, I have to say, promoted by their constant contact on social media. Yeah. So there are downsides. I mean, sometimes they can get into really useless and unpleasant fights with one another. But they also push each other and push each other's thinking. They are very plugged in, and they are very eager to exercise their power as they gain it.
Let me just reintroduce you and get our other guest in the conversation. We're talking about the fact that while we are all living in a tumultuous and stressful time, adolescents and young adults are particularly vulnerable, especially young people of color. And Lisa DeMore is a child and adolescent psychologist. She writes the Adolescence column for the New York Times, co-hosts a podcast called Ask Lisa, The Psychology of Parenting. She's a regular CBS contributor and apparently has written two books for girls or about girls, Untangled and Under Pressure. Joining us now is Howard Stevenson. He's the Constance Clayton Professor of Urban Education, also Professor of Africana Studies in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also Director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative and Forward Promise. Howard Stevenson, you've been a guest on Radio Times many times, and nice to have you back with us on the show.
Oh, it's great to be back, Marty.
And to our listeners, again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. If you are a young adult or a teenage person, or you live with one or care about one, we do want you to join our conversation. Howard, I've been talking with Lisa, sort of broadly speaking, about the kind of stresses the kids are under. Many kids are home with their parents. Lisa was also talking about just their resilience and that young people have a lot going for them. And I don't want to lose sight of that. But I do want to talk about this time where young people of color, black kids, black teenagers, young black adults are being exposed to, I think what we're all being exposed to, these videos, these images of George Floyd under the knee of the police officer and dying. Now, there's a new video of Daniel Prude, who died at the hands of the police. It was ruled a homicide a couple of months ago, and yet we're just seeing the video now. What is it like for young black people, young black men and women, girls and boys, as they live through this really difficult time?
Well, it's quite amazing because of the way in which they're going to have to and have been trying hard to manage all this information coming at such a rapid pace. I know you were talking earlier about stress and the enormous pressure that places on young people to how they think about themselves, how they manage their sadness, and also being sort of kept out of social networks that would, you know, traditionally help navigate some of this stress. For black and brown adolescents, there's also the notion of racial stress. And I think in some of our research around, say, parenting stress versus parents of color who have to be stressed about the racial profiling of their children, those are very different types of stressors. And we know that those different types of stressors affect parents physiologically and emotionally very differently. And the same is true for teenagers, because they have to navigate that their very existence, their identity and humanity are on trial, whether they stay home or not. And so I think the kind of work that needs to be done has to appreciate not only the impact of, you know, the pandemic stress, but what's it like where you can see on television these videos over and over again and not have any particular place to make sense of that?
Yeah. Howard, hold on one second. Let me just get Lisa DeMore to weigh in. And I'd be curious, Lisa, about your thoughts. As I said, you know, we're all viewing this, but I think the impact on young people of color is even more distinct and more stressful.
Absolutely. And we've studied stress for decades. And one thing that we know is that it's dynamic, that it accumulates. So, you know, everyone's under the stress of COVID-19, but that means different things to different people. Because if you've already been under the stress of being non-white in this country, that pervasive and constant stress that comes with that, and then you layer COVID-19 on top of that, that really changes what it means to be in these hard times. And we should never allow ourselves to slip into the assumption that this storm feels the same for everyone. Everyone who comes into this storm comes in a different boat. And we need to be mindful of what was in place before, what has happened since, and how those then interact with the overriding stress that we're all feeling around COVID-19.
Howard, let me go back to you. And I mean, you and I have talked about, you know, black parents and quote unquote, the talk, you know, how to talk to your children about how you could be perceived in public and how to behave if somehow you have some interaction with the police. But I wonder, even beyond that, and we know from this pandemic that the most vulnerable populations are the ones who are paying the greatest price. That tends to be people of color. You know, when you look certainly in Philadelphia and other cities, you see, so who's contracting coronavirus, who's dying of it? It tends to be African Americans, people of color. How should we enlarge that talk, or what should that talk entail then?
That's to me. I'm sorry.
That's to you. I'm sorry. We're all scattered all over the region here. But now go ahead, Howard. That's okay.
Thank you. Sure. Yeah, one of the things we've learned over 30 years is we knew that a lot of families of color gave children the talk. But the reason why we found it useful over those years is that children aren't more prepared when racial hostility comes, right? Not to know that you may be physically assaulted, emotionally assaulted, walking in the street, watching images on television or in school experiences, that being prepared allows you to not internalize the hate that drives a lot of that stuff. And so what we've been trying to say is, how do we improve the talk to include what we know about trauma? And that means, can parents start to tell their own stories about how they had to navigate this in their own childhoods? And children listening from that can glean a host of strategies that just giving the talk directly won't fully suffice. We also know that young people practicing for these scenarios, which are quite common, in the same way that you would practice a skill for how to speak up, being assertive, to not allow someone to say or do something to you without you using your voice, also allows them to reengage in contexts like classrooms and not be sort of sidelined by the oppression.
Let me go back to you, Lisa DeMorn. I thought it was so interesting and so important and revealing when Michelle Obama revealed that she feels like she's suffering from low-grade depression. And I think even beyond race is just the importance of acknowledging how it is that we are feeling and why that's so difficult.
It's true. I think a lot of people right now are feeling kind of helpless and somewhat hopeless. And I was really really appreciative that she gave voice to that. When we're in hard times, there are some things we can do that help us feel better, even if we can't fix the situation we're in right away or even as quickly as we want. And one thing is actually to do what she did, which is just to name it. Mm-hmm. There's something, this is what Dr. Stevenson and I do professionally and have learned, there's something about saying the word, you know, I feel depressed, I feel really helpless right now, that in and of itself does help to take some of the edge off of that experience. And then the other thing we can do is in expressing that and communicating that, we find that we're not alone in it. So it's one thing to feel really down. It's one thing to feel like you're the only one who feels down. And so when we start to talk about it and even start to talk about hard things, we get some relief just in the talking. We get some more relief in the companionship. And then I think it does open the door for us to start to think in more hopeful ways. When we are able to really sit with painful feelings, it lets us start to think about what we might do to help ourselves feel better, even in the short term.
And I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Lisa DeMoor, who joins us along with Howard Stevenson. We're talking about young people living in these stressful times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Just to recap what we're talking about, as we all know, we are all living through a tumultuous and stressful time. But for adolescents and young adults, this can be a particularly stressful and vulnerable time. We're talking about the toll that pandemic is having on the mental health of teens and young adults. Also, the additional stresses of police-involved killings on young people of color. And again, our guests are psychologist, adolescent psychologist Lisa DeMoor, psychologist and Penn professor Howard Stevenson. And again, you can join us. There are several ways you can do it. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments, do join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Howard Stevenson, let me go back to you, but also picking up on what Lisa DeMoor was saying right before the break. And I'm thinking about the protests that we have seen throughout the summer, how racially diverse they are. They're diverse age-wise, but I'm particularly struck by just the sea of young faces, many of them masked, not all of them, but many of them masked, protesting in this sort of moment of racial reckoning. Do you take comfort from that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And because I think the chances of young people learning the skill sets to how to speak up around racial injustice is important, and that you can only learn those skills through this kind of practice and protest. And I think another heartening part of that is that young people might also, from very different racial backgrounds, influence their parents who may not have those skills, frankly. I think the one challenge of thinking about racial addressing racial injustice is how long can you sustain this kind of protest? And I think in our work, we're finding that sometimes it's easier to do a sort of general group thing, and it's harder to navigate the kind of racial face-to-face encounters that happen that people get overwhelmed by. So when I'm in a crowd, I can speak up against injustice. But when I have to make a decision in less than 2 minutes, whether it's something I see and witness when I'm the only one there, that takes a lot more set of practices and skills. And how do I manage my fear, or how do I not say the wrong thing? So the racial stress of face-to-face racial justice work, I think, needs a lot more practice than you can get simply from doing these group protests.
Oh, that's so interesting. Lisa DeMore, this, I wanted to pick up on what you were saying earlier about, again, broadly speaking, that young adults and teenagers are particularly sort of direct and honest in how they feel. And it seems like you were saying this is a new development.
Well, certainly new development in their age, right? That one of the things that is true is that you can kind of pull the wool over a child's eyes or over an adult's eyes. But once you've got somebody who's a teenager, it's very hard to put anything past them. And then their ability to be in discourse with one another in these really rapid and often critical call-out ways has made them sharper than I think previous generations were. And I think one thing I'm watching among white teenagers is more pressure from teenager to teenager to see racial justice work as their work. And I think that feels increasingly pervasive, and it's wonderful to see. But what Dr. Stevenson is describing of, you know, being a person of color and having to make choices about how to handle racism in the moment, it is imperative that parents of white young people are making clear to their own kids that it is their job, you know, needless to say, not to engage in that, but also to work actively against it whenever they see it.
Let me pick up on that. And Howard Stevenson, I ran across a quote from you, and I'm quoting here, "Racial socialization and racial literacy is more important than your own racial background." I hope I have that right. I hope you were quoted correctly, but I'm interested in having you flesh that out for us.
Yeah, thank you for something that was quoted correctly. I appreciate that.
doesn't always happen. Yeah, but go ahead.
Doesn't always happen. Yeah. No, the idea that most of our research, when we think about race and the politics, our understanding of knowledge tends to make comparisons categorically between black and brown people by these sort of general race categories that don't really talk about the lived experiences of black and brown people. So the measurement is woeful if we only compare whites versus blacks on general dimensions. Stress would be an example. But if you have a measurement of what's it like to be black and the racial stress of being black, those are better ways to understand. And so socialization and literacy includes stories and experiences that tell people a lot more about how I've negotiated well or not so well the politics and aggression of race than just because I belong to this category.
You know, you both of you like teenagers and young adults, and I say that because I think a lot of adults don't like them, or at least don't understand them. You know, you often hear, well, when I was a young person, you know, I didn't lie around and on my phone all day long. What do those adults, I'll put this first to you, Lisa DeMore, I mean, what don't they get about teenagers?
That's a good one. I wish I knew. I mean, so you're totally right. There are plenty of grown-ups who don't like teenagers. And one thing that I love about teenagers is they can smell those grown-ups at 3 miles. You know, they are very aware of who looks askance at them just because they are adolescents. And I often have thought about, like, what does it mean? What does it mean when somebody has just a wholesale bias against teenagers? And sometimes I think, you know, maybe being a teenager was really rough for them and really loaded, and there's something about that just time of life that they want to keep at arm's length. I think there's also a way in which it's easy to stereotype teenagers as being, you know, out of control or, like, you know, really racy. And I think people sometimes want to confirm for the world that they themselves are in good control and not racy by, you know, holding a prejudice against teenagers. But I also think that teenagers have X-ray vision for people's personalities. And they are very good at sizing up adults. And not all adults enjoy that about teenagers. And I think sometimes when grown-ups are not fond of teenagers, I think it's because they know the teenager has their number and they don't really like that.
Oh, that's so interesting. Howard, how do you see it?
Oh, yeah, I love teenagers as well. And I happen to have a 29-year-old son and a 15-year-old son. So I've gone through it a couple of times in different angles. And it is challenging to our own sensibility, no matter how many years of degrees we have around teenagers. Having one is a different life. What I love about teenagers, though, is they're not in addition to what Dr. Moore is saying regarding they see the kind of moral confusions that we have put ourselves in as adults, but they're also willing to cross boundaries and open doors for us that we didn't think were open, were able to be open. And so by being intrusive in the way that they see what we have adults tried to hide and cover up, they give us possibilities that we were afraid to consider. And so I love that. And some of our work, we've taught some basic racial literacy skills to young people, how they morphed it and used it in their own relationships with other students. It was just geometric in terms of the power of their intrusion and their risk-taking that I found to be incredibly hopeful and healing.
Nice to hear that from both of you. Lisa, let me go back to you. And here's just a really basic practical question, which is, and this is based on anecdotes that I've heard from parents who are home with their teenage children about just nagging them about homework and taking out the trash and helping out and all that kind of stuff. Is there a better way to do that?
Oh, probably. And I say this also as a mother of a teenager myself. I have a daughter who's almost 17, so I'm trying to live it. Just like Dr. Stephen said, you know, nagging has its place. In my family, I like to call it a helpful reminder. Would you like a helpful reminder? Nobody here thinks I'm funny, but I think I'm funny.
And you don't get eye rolls with something like that?
Oh, I get eye rolls. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. But I do think it's helpful to just say, you and I both know the trash needs to be taken out. I trust you'll do it is another way to do that. And what I would say about teenagers is that in my mind, they all have two sides. They have an immature, impulsive, not altogether helpful, sometimes dragging their feet side. And they all have a brilliant, philosophical, wise, mature side. And I find that the side that you speak to is the side that shows up for the conversation. So if you say, why haven't you taken out the trash? You're going to get the, I haven't had time, blah, blah, blah. And if you say, you must be very busy because you and I both know the trash needs to go out. Like, what's the plan? You'll get a plan. Oh, and wow. I think adults can do a huge amount to shape what shows up from a teenager. And teenagers are easily provoked. And you can provoke them to be their best selves or their not such good selves. And we need to be mindful of that power that we have.
Mm-hmm. Howard, this is on a completely different subject, but a very important one. A question from Diane. She says, in Philadelphia specifically, we also have a gun violence epidemic, often with teenagers shooting teenagers. What are your guests' thought on this? And we talk about police-involved shootings, but there are teenager-involved shootings that are, in many ways, you know, part of too many young people's lives.
Yeah. I mean, in the way that we think about how over the decades, systemic racism has affected how neighborhoods are constructed in this country, where we live and how we have access or lack of access to resources. And in the same way, we see the pandemic affecting the emotional well-being and even depression of young people now. The same is true around aggression. That is, violence is another expression of how we see the world. And if for some of us, we negotiate through internalizing that sense of sadness. And I see violence also another way of trying to manage unsuccessfully what it's like to live around a certain sense of hopelessness. And for too long, we've somehow thought that depression is related to only an internalizing reality or sort of lethargic reality, when in fact being active and aggressive can also reflect the sadness and depression that about the way the world is going.
These are really, really tough times. I'm looking at my clock. We just got a couple of more minutes. I want to just see if we can pull some suggestions, helpful ideas together. And Lisa DeMore, in terms of young people wanting to connect with their friends, and as you say, you know, they're very adept at doing this online. I think when they're together in the same party or the same place, can parents really trust that these young people are doing the things that they're supposed to do to be socially distant? How do we help with that?
Well, I think what Dr. Jensen would say is we probably can't trust that when they get into pretty, you know, intense or charged social situations, that they're going to remember to follow all the rules that they promised to follow as they left the house. So one particularly unfortunate aspect of the pandemic is that if teenagers are going to socialize, they probably need some parameters around it to keep it safe. So that may be the parents say, have your friends over. We will, you know, just be in the backyard. We'll peek out the window every once in a while, but we'll leave you alone. But I need to know that you're staying a good distance, or go on a bike ride with them, you know, and wear your masks if you feel like that's a good idea. If there's any worry about getting too close, mm-hmm. We need to be creative. We need to be thinking with them about what will work, but they do need to see their friends. I don't want people to feel that there's nothing to be done on this. We have to get, you know, come up with new ideas about how to do it. But it is critically important that teenagers have time in person with their age mates. It is a huge part of becoming an independent young person is to loosen the ties to your family at home and strengthen the ties to your peers. So that trajectory towards independence does require that we help them find safe ways to see their friends.
And Howard Stevenson, I'm also thinking about the fact that so many schools are online now. And for a lot of young people, having a relationship with a teacher can mean all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. What do we need to support that relationship?
I think that, you know, when we went online, many of us thought because we spend so much time with young people and families face to face that this is going to be a big hit in the relational world. But I've found that online there are ways to make connections, that listening still matters in this process. And I wouldn't underestimate the power of connection online for young people. And, you know, for many of the young people who really weren't feeling great about the social, the quality of social relationships at school, you know, virtual sort of spaces give some youth a chance to be themselves in ways they don't feel comfortable around other people. And I think, you know, teachers can maximize that, could do a lot around, I think, in tracking how I'm connecting even in this virtual space.
You want to add to that, Lisa? That this is an interesting thing that for some people, being online is maybe better than being in person in school.
I will say I've had something happen in the pandemic that I did not ever imagine was a possibility, which is that I've done some sessions with groups of teenagers online where I've said to them, you know, I'll give them a few, you know, hum a few bars about what's on my mind. And then I'll say, yeah, use the chat to ask me anything. Mm-hmm. And I won't read your name, but I will read your question. So you'll know I'm answering your question and I'll answer it. And then I'll answer it to the whole group of students. But the student who asked knows it's their question. And then I have students put things in the chat like, we should do it all the time this way. I would never raise my hand in class to ask a question like this. Mm-hmm. And I have had questions, and I will say, especially from boys, where I think as I see the question, I think there is no way you would lay that out in front of your peers and I get to answer it. Mm-hmm. And I've had kids say, we shouldn't go back to normal health class after this. We should always do it this way. So I'm with Dr. Stevenson. There are possibilities here that should be explored. They are different. They may be better, or they may just tide us over.
Well, I really appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Drs. Lisa DeMore and Howard Stevenson, thanks so much for joining us. I feel like we just got the conversation started.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Lisa DeMore, child and adolescent psychologist, also writes the adolescence column for the New York Times, co-host of a podcast called Ask Lisa, the Psychology of Parenting. Howard Stevenson, the Constance Clayton Professor of Urban Education, Professor of Africana Studies in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania, also Director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative and Forward Promise. Go to whyy.org/ /Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aronson, Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.